Bishop, and I am with Project Benjamin, which is a Torah-based messianic ministry in Costa Rica, Central America. How many people thought Costa Rica was in the Caribbean Sea next to Puerto Rico? Okay, that's typically what we get. What island are you near? What island are we near? Panama? It throws people. Yet we are in Central America. We have been there for 5 years, establishing fellowships, working with indigenous people. We do not have, we have a small English group that sort of happened by accident, people moving down, but that is actually dispersing even as I speak. People are leaving, they're going on to other things. It was more of a stopping over place, and that part of the ministry really was not the intent of what we wanted to do. There's a lot of people that speak English in the world, and they live in English-speaking countries, and there's a lot of you that are able to teach them, but there weren't a lot of people in Costa Rica who were doing Torah. There are a whole lot more now, and not directly because of me and the ministry that we're doing there, but because of other people. As we started doing the ministry, we found people all over Costa Rica who were actually keeping Torah, but they thought they were the only people there keeping Torah. And so then we got, there's one here, and there's a family there, and there's three guys there, and we found out there's a whole bunch of people that we just didn't know about before. I'm going to go through a little teaching because I have this problem with doing a strict promotional kind of thing about the ministry when it's Sabbath, because Sabbath is about Him and His Word. So as a segue into what I'm going to share at the end, and we're going to get to some pictures, we're going to get to some specifics about the ministry at the end, I'm going to present something that I've presented before, and the last time was at a 7-day conference. I will try to keep the teaching to one day this time. I had originally planned to teach the extreme accuracy of the rabbinic calendar, but I figured we had enough calendar for one day, so we won't do that. What I want to present to you is, how many of you have ever read the in Bereshit in Genesis 38? You got to the story of Judah and Tamar, and you said, why is that in the middle of the story of Joseph? Anybody ever wondered that? What is that? What is that whole thing, that whole chapter about it? Does it seem like it's out of place? I was like, why is it there? Well, I'm going to show you why it's there, and we're going to look at it. And I have titled this, Judah and Tamar, Prophecy Within a Prophecy. Okay. Now, I'm going to skip over, for time's sake, reading some of the scripture. So if you have a pen and a paper and you want to check me out, and you want to make sure I'm not, you know, blowing smoke, write down the scripture reference right away when I go to a slide, because I may not read it. I may just paraphrase the slide, because some of the slides are really long. And how many people have no idea what it says about Judah and Tamar? I've absolutely never read it before. I have no clue what it's about. Okay, see, we all kind of have a general idea what it's about. We're going to look at some specific things, and we're going to go through it, but I'm going to rush through a few parts because, rather than just bore you to death with my voice reading over and over and over again the scripture, we're going to get to the point. Okay, we want to know, what is this all about? So, this is the opening chapter, which we're going to see again, or the opening paragraph, which we're going to see again, introducing the characters. Basically, Judah takes a wife who is not from Israel, has three sons, and gets a wife for his first son named Er, and her name was Tamar. Now, Tamar is going to be one of the main characters we're going to focus on. We're going to read this when we get to later on. We're going to go through the chapter, because that's what the teaching's on, the chapter. So we are going to read the chapter, but we're going to read it in context with the teaching. What are the three keys to understanding Scripture? Before we get started, we all have to agree. What are the three keys to understanding Scripture? Context. What's the second key? Context and context. That's right. She's got it there ahead of me. You've heard this before. Okay, well, I'm done. Never mind. Sorry. Let's just get a general idea of what's going on. Bereshit 37 is the story of Joseph and his family, where we have the dreams of Joseph, you know, the sun and the moon bowing to him, and the sheaves bowing, and all that stuff, you know, and he's kind of a little uppity at that point. He consequently gets sold into slavery, and then they lie to Jacob saying he's dead. And Joseph, at the end of chapter 37, we see Joseph is dead. Now, what's Judah doing? What is Judah doing? Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh, and his brothers listen to him." Now, unfortunately, this is kind of where we get the idea that Jews are good at making money. Because he's like, let's not kill him, let's make some money. We see that Judah, really the point of this is we see that Judah doesn't always do things the right way. And he's real good at turning his back on his responsibilities, because we know easily that Torah says in Deuteronomy 24:7, if a man is caught kidnapping someone and kills him or one of his countrymen and kills him or sells him, he's to be put to death. Right? Okay, so we see that this is clearly a no-no in Israel. This wasn't like some kind of custom that they were routinely selling their brothers off, or, you know, they didn't do that. This was bad. Okay, Bereshit 38, as I said, Judah has children. Judah takes a wife for his oldest. Successively, the two older children die for their sin. Tamar waits for Shelah, the youngest. Tamar takes matter into her own hands. Judah goes into a harlot, which we'll look at later. Tamar is sentenced to death, and Tamar's righteousness is revealed. That's kind of the executive summary of chapter 38. And then chapters 39 through 50, the continuing story of Joseph, his rise to power, his reconciliation with his brothers, salvation for all his family, and finally ending in chapter 50 with his death in Egypt. Okay? So we've got just kind of a general idea of what's going on. We got a context of the scriptures. So what is the story of Joseph really about? Because obviously that's the bigger story, and what we have is a little story and a bigger story. So what's the bigger story about? And I picked this verse to kind of summarize what the story of Joseph is all about. God sent me, and Joseph is speaking, before you to preserve you, for you a remnant in the earth, and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. By a great deliverance. Now, to really understand how that applies to us, we have to look at the two house in Ezekiel 37. Okay? Bear with me on this. I know there's like 57 million different versions of what the two house theory is. And the one house, and the whole house, and et cetera, and et cetera, and et cetera. But let's look at this, because I want to read this one, because we're going to make a couple of points, and then we're going to move on. This isn't the focus. "And you, son of man, take for yourself one stick and write on it for Judah and the sons of Israel, his companions, then take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel, his companions. Then join them for yourself one to another into one stick, that they may become one in your hand. When the sons of your people speak to you, saying, 'Will you not declare to us what you mean by these?' Say to them, 'Thus says the Lord Yahweh, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will put them with it, with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be one in my hand.'" Okay? That's just what it says. So let's agree on three things. I like the three. I like the number three. It's prevalent in Scripture. I like it. There, according to Ezekiel 37, we're not going to bring in all the other plethora of information we could bring in from other parts of the Bible. There are two houses of Israel. Does anybody got a problem with that? According to Ezekiel 37, there are two houses of Israel, okay? They will be reunited by him. Any problems with that? We are some part of them if we are waiting for Messiah. Any problem with that? If we're in agreement with that, we can go forward, because you won't have a problem with the rest of it, I hope. But that's important. Somebody had a problem with these three points. Now we have an issue that we have to deal with. So let's talk about Benjamin. You'll notice that the name of our ministry is Project Benjamin. What you don't know is that my son's name is also Benjamin. But the ministry was not named for my son. I'm sorry, it's not yours. You don't get it when I die. No, that's not how it works. But they were both named for the same person. Can anybody guess who they were named for? Benjamin in the Bible. Benjamin in Bereshit. That guy. The founder, the father of the tribe of Benjamin. And now we're gonna look at we're still looking at the bigger context of the bigger scriptures, okay, the bigger story. We're still looking at the bigger. They're still getting the context of what's going on. Jacob saw that there's grain in Egypt. Again, I'm just gonna paraphrase it. He saw there was grain in Egypt. Jacob says, "Go down and get some grain." The ten brothers go down. They don't take who? Benjamin, because the father said, oh, Joseph is dead. Remember, Joseph is dead, quote unquote, dead. So he doesn't want Benjamin to go because it is the sons of his beloved wife. And so he said, you can't take Benjamin down because I'm afraid harm will befall him. So what do? They go down to Egypt. Do they get grain? Yes. But what happens to Simeon? They put him in a hoosegow because Joseph saw his brothers and he recognized them, but he disguised himself to them and spoke to them harshly and said, where have you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. But Joseph had recognized his brothers, important, although they did not recognize him. They did not recognize him. He put Simeon in the prison, saying, oh, you're spies, you've come to spy out the land. If you're telling the truth, bring your brother Benjamin down to me. What was Joseph thinking? They probably bumped off Benjamin too. Okay? He wants to see that his brother is okay. His only full brother is okay. So they get the grain, they go back. Remember, the money's in their sack. They go back to Canaan, they eat the grain. And then Jacob says to the brothers again, he says, go down and get some more food. We're out of food. And Judah says, we can't do that. If the man said, if we come down there without Benjamin, he won't even speak to us. And we got Simeon in jail. He may be dead already. We don't know what happened to him. But we're not all going to go down there and take this big chance unless you send Benjamin with us. You will not see my face unless your brother Benjamin is with you. Okay, we're up to speed on this. I know I'm going fast through this part. It's just background for what I really want to share. Okay? And if we don't want to be here till 9, 9:30, 10 o'clock, just kidding. Now let's talk about Benjamin. Obviously a key important piece here is that Benjamin has to come down. Why is Benjamin so important? Because when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said, bring the men into the house and slay an animal and make ready, for the men are to dine with me at noon. So the man did as Joseph said, and he brought the men into Joseph's house. The key for Joseph was that he saw his brother Benjamin. That was like, okay, now is the time. Now is the time. He brings the brothers in and he sits down. Remember, he puts them in order of birth. And they're like, what's going on? He knows our birth order. And Benjamin gets the extra portions, you know, five times as much. And they're like really bugging out. And they're talking. And you know, I can imagine Joseph up there going, I understand everything they're saying, but I can't let on. You know, he's just kind of like grinning. It's like, this is really cool. They have no idea who I am. But then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried, have everyone go out for me. So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Could you just imagine? Oh, no. We thought for sure he'd be dead by now. He's the boss. We have a problem. We have a problem. Benjamin was the catalyst for the reuniting of the brothers. Because Benjamin was there, they were reunited. Prophetically, we are Benjamin. Now, who do I say we? I'm going to use the term messianics. Those that are walking in Torah and those that have the testimony of Messiah. Messianics. We are Benjamin. We are bridging the gap between Judah and Joseph, spirit and truth, because we are walking with both. Now, incidentally, not part of this, but something that occurred to me is which tribe of Israel was almost wiped out by its own people? Benjamin. The end of the book of Judges. Benjamin is almost completely wiped out. I think like 700 people left in the whole tribe. The whole tribe, 700 males left. I think all the females are killed too. I mean, there's a war, and it's the other tribes that attack them because they do some heinous thing with the Levite's concubine, and they are almost wiped out by their own brothers. Who doesn't like us? Does Judah like messianics? Do Christians like messianics? So Are these not our brethren? Are they not part of us? Do they not all adhere to the same God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? But what are they trying to do? They're trying to wipe us out. Yeah, that's right. They want us to go away. They want us to go away. That's what Project Benjamin is essentially about. The story of Joseph, the prophecy of Joseph, is the restoration of both houses or all the tribes of Israel. That's what Project Benjamin's focus is, restoring all the 12 tribes, getting everybody back under one roof, as it were. Okay, there is a rabbinic prophecy that they, in their writings, that says when the 12 tribes come together, Messiah will come. So we've seen other things in Scripture, but that is something that Judah is waiting for. And I'll be honest with you, I wouldn't be real upset to see it myself. Now, I told you all that to tell you about this, a brief history of the Sephardic. How many people know who the Sephardic are? A couple of people. Okay, well, this is good. I'm going kind of fast. If I say something you don't understand or just completely, you know, raise up your hand. I'm used to doing it in Spanish because sometimes when I teach in Spanish, I say words that don't exist on this planet. Because they're not really Spanish and they're not really English. And sometimes they got a little Spanish and a little English and a little Hebrew mixed in the middle. And they go, what in the world is that? Or I simply say things that, assuming that people already know something that you may not know. Okay? Because I've got it all up here where it's safe for me and everyone else. And sometimes I'm thinking about something, but I haven't made it clear. So if I say something that you don't understand, especially as I'm going quickly through this part of it, please raise your hand and ask a question. It won't upset me at all. Matter of fact, make me feel good. The information I'm about to share about the Sephardic comes from the Las Raíces Judeo Sefarditas de Pueblo de Costa Rica, or the Jewish Sephardic roots of the nation of Costa Rica, by my friend Rabbi Dr. Conrao Umaña. Was one of my early rabbis, still a very, very good friend of mine, taught me a lot, and taught me everything, almost everything I know about the Sephardic. So that's where that comes from. We find the word Sephardic in Obadiah 1:20, and the captivity of this host of children of Israel shall possess that of the Canaanites, even unto Zarephath, and the captivity of Jerusalem, which is in Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the south, the Negev. Okay, that's where it comes from. We have to go all the way back to King Solomon. Now, how many kingdoms were there under the King Solomon? Was there one or two? One. What was it called?
Israel.
Very good. Somebody's paying attention. Israel. Okay? None of my questions are really, what's the word? I can't remember the word. Okay. I'm looking for, if I ask a question, I'm looking for a response. Okay? So during the reign of Solomon, there were three major migrations from Israel. They were not forced migrations. They were voluntary migrations. The people left to go make money. What was Solomon doing? Bringing in all these goods, right? Then the people said, wait, we're making all this money importing these goods. Hey, maybe if we go over there, we can export and import. We'll send part of the family over there. They'll export. We'll be part of the family here. We'll import. We'll make double the money. Okay? It's pure economics. One of the places they went was Yemen. Another was Ethiopia. We just recently heard of the Ethiopian Jews several years back that came back to Israel. And the Iberian Peninsula, Spain. These communities later multiplied in size during the time of the exile of Assyria and Babylon, but that was more of a, they escaped to these communities when Assyria and Babylon came in and invaded Israel. They escaped during that time. We see here in 1 Kings 5:6 that how they did it was through the connection with Phoenicia when they were building the temple. Remember, Solomon had Hiram in Lebanon, and Phoenicia was cutting, the Sidonians were cutting the timber and stuff, and he was trading people back and forth, and they had the ships going. And we see here that this is Israel, and these are the Phoenician trade routes. They go all the way over here to this little bitty piece of land, which is really much bigger than Israel, called Iberia. Okay? This is Portugal and Spain today. And even there are evidences that it came all the way around up here to the British Isles, that the Sidonians made it all the way to the British Isles. But this is how Israel began to disperse. And remember, it was voluntary. They were going for commerce, which is not a very unusual way that peoples dispersed in the world, and it's still how it happens today. That's why instead of everybody living in the same little town, you'll have your children and your grandchildren and everybody moving away. Why? For better jobs. They'll disperse for commerce. It's very, very, very common. So we see that Israel dispersed to the Iberian Peninsula. Now, obviously, that's the one we're going to focus on because I want to talk about the Sephardic. I don't want to talk about the Ethiopian or the Yemenite Jews. But we continue on during the 4th and the 3rd centuries BCE, before the Common Era, while the Greeks occupied much of Eretz Israel, the people now known as Jews. Why were they known as Jews? It's important. Because what happened to the northern kingdom of Israel? Poof. It's gone. It got swallowed up by Assyria. The Assyrians ate it. What's it now called? In this time? Samaria. Samaria. They called it Samaria because they mixed. They took people from other nations and they brought them in. And then they mixed the Jews and these other peoples. There's a whole plethora of peoples that got mixed up in there. But Israel didn't exist. It was just Judah, so they began to call all the people Jews. Not because they were from the tribe of Judah, but because they were from the nation of Judah. So, these Jews migrated to the already established communities in the Iberian Peninsula, Spain, called Sepharad in Hebrew, and the people became known as Sephardic Jews. Okay? Now, that's how they got there, and that's how they got their name. During the same time, many Jews went to Asia Minor and populated all the way to the north of Europe. These became known as Ashkenazi Jews. How many of you think you might have descendants that came from Europe? I'm an Ashkenazi Jew. Okay? And I live among Sephardic people, so go figure. It just worked that way. My family came from the Lower Rhine Valley, and there's evidence that we have some Jewish ancestry, although I was not raised a Jew. I was raised a Methodist. And here you go. Just proof that God can save anybody, okay? He can just pull anybody out of anywhere. So, yeah. But that's another migration. So that's where the split today. We know that there are two basic schools of thought with Judaism. One is Sephardic, which is also the form of the language used in Israel. And the prevalent, the black penguins, as you see here with the black hat and the curly Qs and all that, and the black coat is mostly Ashkenazi Jews. But that's not who we're here to talk about. In Spain, in Sepharad, during the time of the Moorish or Islamic occupation of the Iberian Peninsula, the Sephardics lived in relative peace with both them and the predominant Christian religion, which was Catholic. This was before the Protestant Reformation of the area. Remember, if you were Christian, you were Catholic. That was first. Then came the Protestants. By the 9th century, the Sephardic community had grown to be a prestigious and wealthy sector of Spanish society. It was during this era of prosperity that great achievements in the sciences and in Judaism were accomplished. Moshe ben Maimonides, we're familiar with that name, right? One of the old-time rabbis, was a predominant figure of the time, and that is an actual etching of what he looked like. Yes, that is a turban. They actually didn't wear ball caps. Go figure. That just wouldn't work today. What if we ought to put turbans on our head? You know, it just wouldn't work. We have to have the ball caps. By the 13th century, now we've gone from the 9th century when they are like, they're the what's that new Geico commercial? The bee's knees, okay? They are like the cream of the crop of society. Now, just a few 100 years later, by the 13th century of the era Comun, the Common Era, excuse me, the Catholic Church began to forcibly convert the Jews to Christianity, or they were forced to forfeit all holdings and most often their lives. The Inquisition was begun in 1480 and lasted 12 years, culminating with the decree of expulsion of all Jews from the territory of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella in the year. Does anyone know? Yeah, if you can do the math, we had it set up for the math. We had the math set up ahead of time. If you can do the math, 1492. Who else did something really weird in 1492? Christopher Columbus. The decree of expulsion went into effect the last day of the month of July in 1492. This is history. Google it. You'll see I'm telling you the truth. Or you can just trust me. It's up to you. Christopher Colon was his name. It wasn't Columbus. I'm sorry. I know your history books all said his name was Columbus. It really wasn't. That's an English version of his name. Left Spain on the 3rd of August in 1492, and according to his manifest of crew members, had for the most part a shipload of Sephardic Jews. What were they doing? They were running away. That's what they were doing. They were trying to save their lives. Here is the famous Christopher Columbus signature on the top. It stands for the Hebrew underneath it. In a recent article entitled, Was the Discoverer of America Jewish? By Newton Frohlich, it was noted the letters stand for a Latinized Hebrew prayer, Sanctus, Sanctus, Adonai, Sanctus, Chesed, Moled, Yehovah, or God, God, Lord God, grant us mercy. The last two lines are said to be Columbus's signature, Expo Ferens, has been translated as the Greco-Latinized form of his name, and El Admirante means the admiral. And even his signature was a cryptic form of announcing that he was a Messianic Jew. How many of you knew that Christopher Columbus was a Messianic Jew before right now? It was very, very common in Spain to have hidden ways of identification. My wife has a Sephardic Star of David. And when you put it on, it's a Star of David. But when they wore that in the synagogue, when they went out in the street, it opens up and it looks like a bunch of butterflies. And they had many things like that so that they could wear them. Now, someone else who had the same thing would see the butterflies and know what that was. But anybody else would just walk and say, oh, look, pretty butterflies. But when it's closed and you walk inside, it's sort of like that's where the idea of why do you not see people, hardly even in Israel, walking around with their tallit on all the time? Because they would get killed if they walked around with their tallit on all the time. It was part of the dress originally, and it became a hidden thing because of persecution. Okay? That is key to what we're doing today. We're seeing the reverse of the persecution. Now, back to Christopher Colon. On his fourth voyage, Christopher Colon discovered the Atlantic coast of Costa Rica. Now that Central America had been discovered, colonization began in Panama and continued up through Nicaragua, headed by persons such as Andres Niños, who was also a Jew. As he passed through the rich coast, he gave Costa Rica its name. Costa Rica, rich coast. Pretty self-explanatory, right? This, incidentally, is Costa Rica, right here. I live right about there. We are a long way away from there. This is the first seal of Costa Rica. Notice anything interesting in the middle of the seal? We see a Chinese throwing star. No, we don't. We see the Mogan David. This is the first flag of Costa Rica. Okay, it's a picture of the first flag of Costa Rica. It's not a real flag. Again, the Mogan David. The original language brought to Costa Rica was Ladino. Who knows what Ladino is a mixture of? What is it a mixture of? Hebrew and Spanish. That is correct. Hebrew and Spanish. Even today, in the Spanish language, there are many Hebrew words that are still being used. Descocherar, which is to damage or lose the condition of kosher, i.e. it cannot be eaten. Okay, they use it, but it's like saying the food is spoiled. Jupa is the head. There's a phrase, me daña la jupa. It's my hit my head. I hurt my head. They say it all the time. Ojalá is from the Arab influence in Spain, which means if God wills. Now that is a standard, it's not a religious term. It's a standard part of the Spanish language. You'll learn it if you go to school just to learn Spanish. They will teach you that that phrase. It means like, I hope so. Some Hebrew customs that are there. And I'm going to tell you, none of the Costa Ricans know why they have these customs. They didn't. They're starting to. They didn't know why before. The Cabildo, which is a governing body of a town having no less than 10 men older than 13 years old. What does that sound like? A minion, that's right. Not pointing at the stars or a rainbow. Why? Because if they did that in Spain, they'd say, oh, look, it's a Jew looking for the three stars that begin Sabbath or end Sabbath. They would go outside and they would count. One, two, three. Oh, it's Sabbath. That's it. Let's go inside. That was their way. They didn't have a little calendar that said candle lighting time in Charlotte, candle lighting time in Atlanta, candle lighting time in Tel Aviv. They didn't have that. They just went outside and they looked for three stars. And said, oh, it's time. Okay? It's officially time. And so they're Costa Ricans. Their kids get their hands slapped. I've seen it. I have seen it. Kids point up at something and pow, grandma slaps the hand. Don't point at the sky. She has no idea why. They say it's bad luck. She has no idea why. Women remain in the home for reasons of health for 40 days after birth. No bathing, bathing, submersion in water during menstruation, and no intimate relations. Again, they have no idea why. I've seen women in Torah study read the laws of Nidah and go, my grandmother taught me that. My mother taught me that. I never knew why. It's right there. Only one pot only used to keep milk in. I know people, it's mostly the grandparents' generation right now that's continued to be, they have a pot that they only put milk in. They heat milk, they do whatever for that, it's just for milk. And Eskazu, the city of witches. Please ask me, why is Eskazu called the city of witches? Because every Friday night, those witches light candles in their homes. It is still, today one of the largest strongholds of the Jewish community in Costa Rica. If you want to find, especially more the Orthodox Jews, that's where you go, and that's where they live, right, even today. Okay, let's get to the point. Okay, all this is kind of in background because you have to understand where we're coming from, where we're going, and why. Then be clear why we're doing what we're doing. Let's go to Bereshit chapter 38. We're going to get to what we're here to study. Okay, what we're here to learn about. And it came to pass at that time that Judah went down to his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hiram. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er. And she conceived again and bore a son, and he called his name Onan. And she yet again conceived and bore a son, and called his name Shelah. And he was at Hizib when she bore him. And Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. Okay? Now we know who all the players are. And Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of Yahweh, and Yahweh slew him. And Judah said unto Onan, go into your brother's wife, and marry her, and raise up seed unto your brother. And Onan knew that the seed would not be his, and it came to pass that when he went unto his brother's wife, that he spilled it on the ground, lest he should give seed to his brother, and the thing which he did displeased Yahweh, therefore he slew him also. What is this called? This is the Levirate marriage in Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10. When a brother lives together and one of them dies, the younger brother, the brother goes in and raises up seed for his brother, so his name will not be cut off. But what does that do to the inheritance? If it's the firstborn dies and doesn't have an heir, and then the brother raises up a son with the wife of the firstborn, who gets the double blessing of the firstborn? Does it pass to the second brother? No, it goes to the son of the first brother. So Onan didn't want to lose. I don't want to raise up somebody who's going to take double portion of my inheritance. It's all about the inheritance. Inheritance, 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 being part of the family. Very important. Be very, very important later on. So we see that they're supposed to do that. We also see that there's an out clause. It goes, continues, if he doesn't want to take his brother's wife, then he goes to the gates of the elders, and he says, the woman goes to the gates and says, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of the city shall summon him and speak to him, and if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, maybe she's not all that wonderful of a person. We don't know why. Then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull the sandal off his foot and spit in his face, and she shall declare, thus it is done to a man who does not build up his brother's house. In Israel his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. This Beit Hazot, Chalvutz Hana'al. Chalvutz is to remove or to, important, cut from mooring. What is a mooring? Where you put a boat, where a ship. And what does it do? Keeps it secure. It's a place of security. When there's a storm, the ships will moor to protect themselves, okay? And the sand was removed. The hana'al is the protective footwear. In the day, they only wore sandals. They didn't have some really nice Guanacaste, Costa Rica boots like I do, which are much more protective. So we see that the removal of the sandals is it takes the protection away. Okay? The inheritance. The protection of the woman was the fact that she was still part of this family. When the man dies, she's no longer part of the family. She's cut off. So it's all about protection for the woman. Okay. Tamar was chosen by Judah to be the wife of his first son, Er. Er was wicked in the sight of Yahweh, and he slew him. And Tamar was left without child of promise or a claim to the inheritance of the tribe. She was dispersed to Judah's second son, Onan, according to Hebrew, the law of the Levirate union. Onan was to raise up seed, Zerah. We're familiar with it. If you studied any Hebrew at all, you've already studied Zerah. I guarantee it. For his brothers, that they might claim the inheritance of the firstborn. This I see as the first exile of the Sephardic to the Iberian Peninsula. They were still clearly Jews, but still promised an inheritance amongst the people. Okay, they went there. Clearly Jews, no problem. They were just living in another place outside of Israel. Onan, however, decided that he did not want to complete the act of Torah, and he spilled his seed on the ground. The Hebrew translation of this form of Strong's definition can also read, he cast off his seed on the earth. Cast off his seed on the earth. Dispersion. Here we have a prophetic shadow picture of the dispersion that would jeopardize the inheritance of Tamar and her people Onan. The text says, did this lest he should give seed unto his brother. Then said, okay, so we're clear of that. The prophetically speaking here, we see that the Sephardics, and I'm going to tie this all in, why we're connecting these two at the end, are first dispersed to the second brother, dispersed to Spain, outside of Israel. Israel is my firstborn, says Yahweh, and then dispersed outside. And then we see that Onan doesn't want to raise up seed. He dies, and Tamar is sent to her father's house. Then said Judah to Tamar's daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah my son be grown. For he said, I am afraid that he will die also, as his brethren did. And Tamar went and dwelt in the house, in her father's house. Here we have a picture of the promise of Messiah. The root of Shelah, Shin Lamed, hey, is the same as that of Shiloh. I propose the statement could read, till Shiloh my son be grown, a reference to Messiah ben David, the ruler of the tribe of Judah. Interestingly, the word here for to be grown, gadal, was represented as an incomplete act of the future. So there's something that yet going to happen. We're waiting for it. It is noteworthy that the Yit Gadal is a reference in the Jewish Kaddish, the mourner's prayer, in which they refer to the coming of Messiah in the Messianic age. Could it be that the Sephardic people were sent away to conceal themselves and live in seclusion outside of the land in a desolate place until the Messiah were to come? We will see. Through the years, anti-Semitism increased, and time and time again, the Jewish people in Iberia were persecuted and pushed towards conversion. Many of the Sephardic Jews had to become Anasine or conversos, converted to Catholicism, Christianity, or face certain death. Under the edict of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain, and eventually a similar edict in Portugal, because at first a large group went to Portugal, the Jews whose ancestors had left before the siege of Babylon and found refuge in the Iberian Peninsula were now fleeing for their lives or else feigning conversion to save the same. It was only through deception and careful concealment carefully concealing their identity that they had hope of claiming their vital inheritance as a ruling tribe of Israel. Remember, they didn't want to. They secretly, outwardly, butterflies. Inwardly, Jewish. They still kept Torah, but they had to do it secretly. After the death of two of his three sons, Judah decided to send Tamar back to live with her father. Genesis 38:11 says, to remain a widow in her father's house or to sit down in a desolate place. We are in a desolate place now. We are dispersed from Israel. It's a desolate place. Or we could just say we're in the wilderness. is another Hebrew understanding. At this time, Tamar had to cover, conceal herself, and wait for the promise of Judah's third son, Shelah. The fact that she was in her father's house is a shadow picture of how Yahweh has never taken his eyes nor his caring hand off the dispersed Sephardic Jews. Okay, returning back to the text. Now, after considerable time, she was daughter of the wife of Judah died, and when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers in Timnah, he and his friend Hiram the Adullamite. It was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat at the gate with the Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. Judah's wife, the mother of Er, Onan, and Shelah dies, and back at Tamar's father's house, Tamar gets word that her inheritance is in jeopardy. Remember, first son dies, she loses the possibility of inheritance. Onan, he doesn't want to raise up seed, he dies, she loses another possibility of an inheritance. She's starting to panic. Only one shot left. Shelah. But she figures out a better way. And it was told Tamar, saying, "Behold, your father has gone up to Timnah to shear his sheep." Father-in-law is from the root choma, meaning to a protective wall. That's kind of the job of a father-in-law, to protect. Okay? Timnah is a portion assigned, and shear is gazaz, the prime root, to cut off. In other words, her security, her wall of protection, was going up to get his portion and to cut her off and out of the inheritance, or out of the flock. Was he going to seek another wife? I propose that he was. He had just turned his back on responsibility, just like Judah did with Joseph. He's dead. Just sell him, he's dead. Turn my back on him. He did the same thing with Tamar. She's dead. Turn my back on her. Okay? The account continues with verse 14, and she put her widow's garments off of her and covered herself with a veil, and because she saw that Shelah had grown. Shelah had grown, and Judah had not kept his promise. Many Sephardics discovered that Shiloh had indeed come. Even though they were forcibly converted to Catholicism, many of them in the Catholicism actually found Messiah through the generations. When the Protestant Reformation happened, it took a lot longer to happen in Central America than it did in Europe. There's many down there that are Baptist and many other Christian, what we would consider mainstream Protestant Christian denominations. And there they found Messiah. They just forgot they were Jewish. They forgot they had any connection whatsoever to Israel. Tamar removes her desolation. She conceals her identity by covering her face with a veil and then sits in plain sight by the double fountain at Timnah. That's just an archaeological fact. Or to claim her double portion, the right of the firstborn, which belongs to the fruit of her womb. Because remember, she was the bride selected for the firstborn. She has that right. Continuing with the text. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here now, let me come into you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you would come into me?" And he said, "Therefore, I will send you a young goat from the flock." Okay? She said, "Moreover, will you give me a pledge until you send it?" He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your seal, your cord, and the staff that's in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. This verse is interesting because it says that when Judah sees her, he thinks her to be a harlot because she has covered her face. This was the fate of the Sephardic people. Their brethren, Judah, saw them as having prostituted themselves with false gods when they saw the crucifixes around their necks. They could not see that it was only to preserve life of the chosen tribe that the Sephardim had hidden their identities, continuing to live and be faithful to Torah in secret, which we can see by the carryover of the Hebrew customs that are still going on, even though they've lost the reasoning behind it. They've lost the reasoning behind it. But they still, over the centuries, that got eroded away. Judah asked to have relations with Tamar, and Tamar, having learned her lesson before, "You fooled me once, shame on you. You fooled me twice, shame on me. We're not going to let it happen a third time." Asked Judah for a pledge of his promised payment for her services. When Judah asks her what she would have him to give her as a pledge, Tamar does not even have to think twice. She asks for it all. The signet ring, the chotam, his bracelets, patil. Note, this is the same word used in Numbers 15:38 in reference to the blue cord that is to be included in the tzitzit. The blue cord represents Messiah. It's the word for cord. Cord. It's techelet. Techelet patail. And his staff, mate, which literally means rod, staff, or tribe. She wanted it all. The authority, the blessing, and the scepter. The claim to the tribe and the kingdom. Amazingly, Judah hands it all over. Where else do we see that in Scripture? Incidentally. This guy comes in from hunting, really hungry. He says, I need some food. I'm going to die. What do I care about my birthright? Give me some of that red stuff. Esau. Esau despises his birthright. Here we see Judah really doesn't care. He really doesn't care. He's in the flesh. Completely in the flesh. Continuing with the text. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. He asked the men who were of her place, saying, where is the temple prostitute who is by the road to Enaim? And they said, there has been no temple prostitute here. So he returned to Judah and said, I didn't find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here. Then Judah said, let her keep him. Otherwise, we will become a laughingstock. After all, I sent the young goat, but you didn't find her. Let her keep all of the keys to the kingdom? I don't know. That Judah, he's a wacky guy. The Sephardim journeyed in 1492 with Christopher Columbus to the Americas. They returned back to the desolate places wearing their garments of exile, but they had conceived truth, Messiah. Through the journey, many of the Sephardim had found the Messiah. They held truth in their hearts, but they continued their lives, conversos on the outside, but secretly keeping Torah and faithfully waiting for the return of Shiloh, their Messiah. Remember, when Judah sends his friend back to look for her, he is told that there was never any harlot there. The Sephardics never really abandoned their belief system. They just added to it. Maybe forcibly, but they added to it. Okay, continuing with the text. Now, it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. Because that is the punishment in Torah for a virgin of Israel who commits harlotry. She obviously didn't have a husband, so she had committed harlotry. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring, whose cord, and whose staff these are. Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. Tamar very wisely asked Judah to scrutinize the three items and decide for himself who the owner is. Judah acknowledges that Tamar had been more righteous than he. After all, he had broken his vow, prohibited his son from completing the Torah, and seemingly taken up with a roadside prostitute, all the while handing over his authority, blessing, and the ruling scepter of the tribe of Judah. Now, to finish out the chapter. It came about that at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out his hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about, as he drew back his hand, that, behold, his brother came out, and she said, what is the breach you have made for yourself? So he was named Perez. Afterwards, his brother came out, who had a scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. Tamar does indeed receive the double portion. See that? Twins are birthed forth from her womb. What was the original promise? Marry the firstborn and receive the double portion. Through a whole weird set of circumstances, she does. Isn't that weird? Isn't God good? You think he did tough with the calendar. He's got to work with people now to get it to come out right. Okay? Once again, we see that the first shall be last and the last first. As the first twin to break forth was Zerah, drawing, breaking forth, and the same word for seed from earlier in our story, the midwife ties a crimson cord on his wrist, but he pulls back his hand and was Perez who actually burst forth and is part of the patriarchal lineage to King David and eventually Messiah Yeshua. How many times do we see the chosen one of Yahweh being the second born? Because Yahweh shows it's not your seed that he chooses, it's his seed in the person that he chooses. Over and over again, the second born is the one that he chooses to use. Zerah fathered a great migration that, interestingly enough, will land you on the Iberian Peninsula centuries later and even to a town named Zaragoza, Spain. Okay. If you remember, word gets back to Judah in the third month that she is pregnant and he assumes that she has played the harlot. This is Kadesha, adultery or idolatry. He tells the family to bring her to him so he can burn her to death. So, in the third month, she's guilty of idolatry and her punishment is death. We can look at this. Now, look at that's physically, she was guilty of adultery and her punishment was death. But what was the claim for the Sephardic? You committed idolatry with this pagan Messiah, because that's how the Jews view Yeshua, unfortunately. And your punishment would deserve death. How many of you know Tony Robinson? He teaches this stuff all the time. The sign of the Messiah. When you see the number 3 coupled with certain death and miraculous rescue from that death, that's the sign of the Messiah in the story. Here we see the third month, the number 3, let her be burned, certain death, and she is more righteous than I, resurrection. We see the a type and shadow here of the work that the Messiah would do. I love pointing it out whenever I see it, over and over and over again in the Scriptures is pointed out the death, burial, and resurrection in 3 days of the Messiah, and here's an example, right here in the story. How many of you ever saw that before? Right there in the middle of the story that you didn't even understand to begin with, because I didn't for years. Here is a sign of the death, burial, and resurrection of Messiah in 3 days. Wow! God's so tricky, isn't he? He's just so tricky. He's slick. Life from the dead. Today, Sephardic Jews all over the world are returning to claim their inheritance in Messiah, in his Torah, and in the land. A lot of them are looking to make Aliyah. With the new law, they're allowing reformed Jews, opening the door for more Jews to return. There is a feeling that it's possible that eventually Messianics will get that opportunity to be able to make Aliyah under the laws of Aliyah to Israel, those that want to. It's not necessarily a happy place to live all the time. I know people who live there, but people who feel called to do that, the doors are beginning to open up for that, we think. They arrive with authority, blessing, and the scepter of the tribe, and Judah must recognize and acknowledge them. This is a beautiful story within the story of the restoration of the whole house of Israel. This is part of the greatest love story ever told, tucked between the pages of the Torah, exactly where it belongs. The prophecy in action, and the captivity of this host of children of Israel shall possess that of the Canaanites, even unto Zarephath, and the captivity of Jerusalem. Where is Jerusalem located? In the southern kingdom of Judah, which is in Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the Negev. This symbol is in many Sephardic communities. The palm tree. Tamar means palm. This is actually how we uncovered the whole thing. Because we read, my wife actually said, Tamar means palm. And she goes, oh my goodness! And we started to midrash and to dig and to look at the words and to go in there and said, oh my goodness. Here in the story of the prophecy of the full restoration of the 12 tribes of Israel, we don't want to do that, don't advance, of the 12 tribes of Israel, we find a story about the restoration of the lost tribe of Judah. How many of you ever heard of that before? Lost tribe of Judah? They are. They were separated from Judah, and Judah will not acknowledge them. This is my family, or the central part of my family. There's two sons that aren't on there, but they've since grown up and moved out of the house and are not there. My son Benjamin is right here. You can go up and meet him and tell him what a good-looking guy he is. He never gets tired of hearing that. My wife, Angie, and my daughter, Sarah, who is 15, going on 25. And they are actually currently in Costa Rica, holding down the fort till I can get back there. We are gathering together the exiled Sephardim in Central America. And for some reason, we're moving forward. This is the communities that we are working with, scattered through mostly the western side, western northern side of Costa Rica. There are 9 communities that we are currently working in. The one saying Tronadora is where, that's where we live, in Tronadora. Guanacaste is the province there. I want to introduce you to a few people. This is Leonardo, and I don't know why my screen is advancing, so bear with me on that. This is Leonardo and Hilda. He is a Messianic rabbi in Punta Arenas, a good friend of ours. He is actually going to communities in Nicaragua. There are 3 communities near Managua, the capital city of Nicaragua, that he has been ministering to. He and his wife also, she goes up and teaches prophecy and teaches the dance. They have dance. And this was telling the young lady earlier that they didn't do much dance in Costa Rica. This would be an exception. They have a fairly nice little synagogue behind their house. They built the synagogue behind the house. And they can do a little, not quite as big as you guys can do up here, but they can do like this little tape circle. They could probably get away with that in Punta Arenas. And they're good friends of ours and primarily have a congregation in Costa Rica and minister in Nicaragua. This is Randall and Gabby. Randall was a pastor in the Iglesias Biblicas until he got into Torah. That's actually my fault. I didn't introduce him to Torah, but I introduced somebody else to Torah, and they introduced him to Torah, and now he ain't got a job. They tossed him out on his keister. Okay? He has a small community, and Patora is an extremely, extremely depressed and fairly dangerous place. It is the only congregation I minister to that I will not take my wife to. Matter of fact, every time I go there, I usually go on the bus because it's cheaper and I don't have to drive, which is a blessing. If I'm a little bit late, I get a phone call. Just checking to see if you're all right. It's like, yeah, I'm fine, you know. It would be considered to be like being in the inner city, big time inner city. But they're precious. They just had their first child, a young boy. And so the blessing of Torah is upon them and their congregation. Later on, we'll see a picture of the Torah study and actually their synagogue, so to speak. This is Pablo. He's the leader of a Cartago fellowship. When I first met Pablo, that wasn't Pablo's family, that was another family. When I first met Pablo, he was about to be divorced from his wife due to infidelity on his part. And their family was a mess. It was just a mess. And we sat and we talked about Torah and we talked about what God's restorative love can do. And we talked about keeping the commandments and we talked about blessings and cursings. And their family is different today. Their family is strong today. He is leading the congregation. He has been cleansed and restored to his wife. That's the restorative work that Yeshua is doing in his world. This is a family in Esparza, Asdrubal and his wife and 2 children. This is the guy that keeps me ministering in the Central Valley. I would go and teach there once a month. And they would give me an offering, and I would use that to go and minister in the Central Valley. And I told him that one day. I said, you know, I just wanted you guys to know that the offering you gave, I really appreciate it. It lets me be able to go and to continue to minister. And they were like, we wanted that for you. I said, well, but I needed to go minister. So the very next month when I went there, they gave me the offering. And then they gave me this huge block of cheese and 2 frozen chickens and a whole bag full of mangoes. I said, take these home and use them. I was like, okay, if I eat all that cheese, I'm going to be in some serious problems. So I had to share some of the cheese, but I did eat the chickens and the mangoes, okay? And that's what they do. They have a heart to see it go out. They have a heart to empower people to go forth. We are also helping families to change, in need to change their circumstances. We developed a program, what's going on with the computer? We developed a program called Teach a Man to Fish. If you go on the website, which I'll show you later, it's a program where we give no interest loans to people. Okay? This is Jorge and Cynthia and Tammy. I'll tell you an interesting story about this. We originally went to Costa Rica with Wycliffe Bible Translators over in Waxhaw. I was with the construction and maintenance department. If you break it, I fix it. That's what I did. Okay, wasn't a translator. Actually never wanted to do that. Sort of what I do now. But that's kind of weird. And so we went down there and we were at language school. We were supposed to go to Peru. And everybody said, just send them to Peru. We said, yeah, send us to Peru. He said, no, you got to go to Costa Rica and learn Spanish. I don't want to go to Costa Rica and learn Spanish. I want to go to Peru. No, you have to go to Costa Rica. They won. And we went to Costa Rica. We're in language school. This is basically a missions language school. Do you know how many Messianic missionaries there are in the world? You're looking at them. As far as I know, you're looking at them, okay? So I'm in here with all the good Baptists and Methodists, and there weren't any Presbyterians, but, you know, it's predestiny. They don't need to send missionaries. And all the people there, and they're all there, and here we are, the good little Jews, under the law, you know, trying to get saved by works. So we didn't have a whole lot of friends. Needless to say, people come up and say, so what do y'all eat, Jewish food? I said, yeah, like fried chicken and mashed potatoes. That Jewish food. So we did have some really good friends, the Berries. Raymond Berry, football player and the coach, his son. First of all, I didn't know who Raymond Berry was until I met his son, and his son told me who Raymond Berry was. But his son was there, and there's a precious family with some three little kids, and they were great, and they had a maid named Anna Eries. Well, one day they had to go off, and we were over there babysitting the children while they were gone, and Anna Eries was there, and she said, I heard this music, and it was Paul Wilbur. And my husband really liked it. Can you tell me what it is? She just happened to be that we were there. And she knew that, you know, I guess the Berries would say, you know, they're Jews and stuff. And there was a little Hebrew in the thing, you know, because Paul throws a little Hebrew in there. And so we started talking to her about it. And we took her to this synagogue we were going to, the Messianic synagogue we were going to called Amen. And she started going there, and then we left from language school and ended up coming back to the States. And we were at the States. We left the mission and we were here for 3 years. But God gave us the prophecy that we would return to Costa Rica after 3 years. Well, lo and behold, almost 3 years to the month, we ended up back in Costa Rica. We get the ministry started going, and we had to wait for the phone line to get hooked up. Well, the phone line finally gets turned on. Oh, we've got the ministry phone line turned on, and it rings. And Cynthia is on the other end saying, I really want to meet you, and I've been watching, you know, I've been looking at things, and I want to come over and meet you guys and stuff. And so she comes over with her husband on their motorcycle. She's about 4 or 5 months pregnant. It's kind of funny because she's sitting really far back on the motorcycle. And they get there and we're having coffee, and she mentions, well, she says, where did you learn your Spanish? I said, at the Institute. Oh, really? My mother used to work for the Institute. So really? Was she a teacher? Oh, no, she was a maid. You wouldn't know her. And I said, oh, really? Yeah, she used to work for a family called the Berries. I said, her name was Anna Eardes. She said, yeah, how did you know? I said, we were the ones that led her to Torah. Get out of town! The first people we met in Costa Rica were fruit of our fruit. But we didn't water the fruit. We didn't do anything to the fruit. We just kind of threw the seed down and said, see ya. Other people did that. God is good all the time. Well, incidentally, long story short, some years later, of course, we stayed very close to the family. Jorge sits in my living room one day and says, I don't even want to live anymore. He's having problems with his wife. Things aren't going well. His job's not going well. I don't even want to live. I thought about killing myself. A week later, Jorge got run over by a drunk driver. He laid in the street bleeding. His right leg. Yeah, right leg almost cut off. His right wrist fractured, bone sticking out. And he laid there and cried out, I don't want to die. I want to live. Don't tell me. Now, he's doing much better. He wanted to live. Yahweh made it possible for him to live. He restored him to a desire to live. John Sanchez came into Torah, recipient of the first fish fund. He bought that truck. He was working for his uncle. His uncle was making $200 or better a month because his uncle owned the truck. John was bringing home 50 bucks for his family of four. He wasn't making it. The uncle up and says, I'm going to sell the truck. I don't want to do this anymore. You're out of a job. Too bad. So sad. Bye-bye. So the fish fund loaned him the money to buy the truck. He bought the truck. But through it, he came into Torah. In Torah, he saw that we're not supposed to owe any man anything but love, unbeknownst to anyone. We didn't find out about it until afterwards. He sold everything in his house to pay off his debts. And they ate on the floor for over a year. And they all slept in the same bed, because they sold the bedroom furniture too, and the tables and the chairs and the couch and everything they had to pay off old debt. Not the truck, because there's no interest loan. He paid it off. He paid it off in 2 years. Do the work. But that's what Torah did to him. He was restored to right standing with those around him. Raf and Patricia from Cartago, their life was marked with, she was in fear of everything. She would call him at work, freaking out, because she was just afraid. He would have to leave work and come home to comfort his wife. Their marriage was a disaster. And then they found Torah. And we got a hold of them. And we walked through Torah principles. And we restored them to the point that at our very first Sukkot celebration, they renewed their vows under the huppah. Their marriage was restored. Their lives were restored. Unfortunately, Patricia, 6 months after this picture was taken, died of aplastic anemia. But she died a whole person, confident in who her Creator was and what her purpose in the world was. She left a precious family behind, but she was a good lady. The Ugaldi family, friends of ours, these are servants. Jimmy, holding little Deborah, has type 2 diabetes. Jimmy's liver is 80% gone. Jimmy, unfortunately, does not have too much longer to live. But he wanted to provide for his family. They were living in a dilapidated, fallen down wooden house. It was terrible. You walk in and the floorboards were just about going through. They had newspapers stuck in all the cracks. But he said, no matter what happens to me, I need to provide for my family. Because it's the Torah way to do it. Because it's what God does for us. He provides for us. They got a loan from the government. They built this house, prefab construction, nothing fancy. But just like everything, as soon as you start digging below the surface, you find all kinds of problems. They had all these foundational issues, and they had to spend the money to do that. Didn't have enough money to finish the house. I'm happy to say that we're in the painting and tile stage of finishing that house. Because he wanted to make sure his family has a place that they could live and won't be out on the street. We've gone to Nicaragua and handed out Bibles and taught. This is a young seminary student who's discussing scripture for the first time. Torah. He's in seminary and he's going, I'm reading the scriptures and they don't say what my seminary professors are telling. This is in Nicaragua. And yes, they actually have seminaries in Nicaragua. We've had people like Rico and his wife Yolanda that have come down to help teach. I want to tell a story on Rico. You know, people always like to tell stories about people. That's what they did. I'm going to tell you a story about what Rico did. Do you see the Bible that Yolanda is holding in her hand? That's Rico's Bible. She just happened to be holding it for the picture. I really don't think it was staged. See the Bible that the little girl in the front row is holding in her hand? Whoop! This Bible right here, that's the same Bible. We were handing out Bibles. All these Bibles are the same. This little girl came up and said, I'd like a Bible. Oh, you sure, sweetheart? Well, when we hand them out, we'll make sure you get one. Well, we started handing them out, and the next thing you know, we were out of Bibles. And the little girl's standing there going, I don't have a Bible. Well, my wife is trying to get somebody maybe to give one of the adults, you know, give up your Bible, and we'll bring one next time. We'll send one with the pastor next week. And Rico reached over, grabbed his Bible off the pew there and handed it to her. This isn't a Torah community. But these people are starting to, they're hungering for the truth. They will be a Torah community. We're still working with that. Rico Cortez cares that people have the ability to read the Word of God. Brad Scott has been there with, Roberto Magna, who's translating for him. That's actually the same place we just had Rico and Yolanda. Do you see them sitting there? This is a typical place that we minister in. Rafa there with his wife always wanted to have a fellowship in his home, so he took out a loan and enclosed the front of his carport. He dug out all the dirt from his yard and he built a patio. Now you sit there in the chairs like this because it's a carport and all the stuff runs out because it does get wet sometimes, so you're a little crooked. But we've had many, many, many services right there in the front of his home. That's how people do it there. They don't have big buildings like this, most of them. There's exceptions, but most of them don't have big buildings. We meet in people's houses. They're hungry to learn. This is us in San Buenaventura. This is my wife, Angie, teaching in somebody's living room, which is a typical way we do it. Here is Patara. I told you about the rough neighborhood. This is where we have our Torah study. This room that we're in is about from here to here wide, and maybe from here to the end of the padding. And we just all cram right in there. It looks kind of big in the picture. We all just kind of cram in there. And what you can't see is where the picture's being taken from is another room where there's more people sitting there like this trying to see while we're doing Torah study. They're hungry. They'll sit in these cramped places to learn. They'd love to have a big building like this, I'm going to tell you what. They wouldn't like to clean it, though. Here is their meeting place behind Randall. He's the guy sitting there eating in the red shirt. Beside Randall's house, this was a place he was turning it into an apartment to try to make some extra money. But when he got so nicely booted out on his keister from his church, he said, you know, Let's just take this place and we'll make this the synagogue. And we're there. I was actually teaching that day, and it's just a room. You see the rough ceilings. That's very typical of what we deal with. Here we are in Nicaragua teaching. This is a much larger church that we're teaching to. This is a much smaller church in Nicaragua. Yes, that is a church. Everybody stands out front. The only people that are underneath generally are, that is the pastor and his family there. Except for the guy on the end, I'm not sure who he is. Here's Upala, which is the only place I go that has a building very similar to this one. Except it doesn't have such nice acoustics. We tried recording last time that Brad Scott was down. We tried recording here. Didn't go well. It was a bust. Everything sounded like this. It just didn't work. So... But it's a great people, and they just love it. They just love it. The pastor there, Martin, said, anytime you get anybody here, you better bring them up this way, or you and me are going to go round and round. Like, okay, we got it. We got a deal. Here is the very first Sukkot we did, and I was told it was the biggest Messianic Sukkot ever in Costa Rica. 75 people. Y'all probably got over 75 people in your fellowship if everybody's here, right? That was the biggest one ever in Costa Rica. It was 2007. 75. Blew me away when they told me that. I thought we were just having our friends up for Sukkot, you know? And that was our first big meeting. Celebrating the Feast of Hanukkah. Again, the porch there. Some Purim. Little kids making it. Oh, here is, and we're going to get this. He's going to flip it in a minute, and I'm going to come back to it. Here it is. This is our Purim custom. We make a piñata. Who is that? Haman, that's right. Actually, it's Diego from Dora the Explorer. Don't tell any of your kids. We modified him a little bit, okay? But that's our... Our tradition, and there's actually another fellowship in Tennessee, the one I'm going to tomorrow, and they saw this and, We want to do that too. So now they have a Haman pinata at Purim for the kids. And I understand that Sherry said something about that was something they were going to have to do also. So we'll see what goes on there. But that's a nice little custom, a little south of the border custom you might want to think about the next time you do Purim. Yom Teruah, we did a hand washing that year. And these are just some photos. This is, of course, this is Rosh Hashanah. This is a more Jewish Messianic synagogue. And my friend Conrado, the one who wrote the book on the Sephardic, this is his synagogue. And he definitely has a more decidedly Jewish flair. And I did not have one single picture with Conrado in it. I was going to put him in here, but I couldn't find a single one. Rico and Yolando entering Sabbath at Punta Arenas. We also give food to people. We decided that people don't listen real well on an empty stomach, something y'all must have figured out because y'all eat before the teaching. I haven't seen anybody sleeping, though. That's pretty good. How do you manage that? You put something in the water? But we bag foods, and we do a food bag, and you'll see them coming up. They're mostly yellow. And it basically gives the staples for a family of four to last almost a week. We're talking like rice, beans, masa to make tortillas out of, oil, oatmeal, which they drink. They don't make oatmeal. They drink oatmeal. Okay? And salt and sugar, and we put coffee in there because, after all, there is no life without coffee. And for about $20, we can put one of these bags together, and we deliver those as often as we possibly can. When there's money for the food bags, we deliver food bags. And we're going to roll through some photos here. This is Rico and Brad bagging up some food bags. You see there's the rice and the beans and the masa. And then we put them in the cars and we deliver them to these places. There we're delivering. These are some friends of ours. They are fishermen from Alaska, salmon fishermen from Alaska. Ben actually fished with him last year, went up and fished. He'd like to return to fish in the future. He said he really enjoyed it. So do you have any connections to fishermen? Let me know. But they're friends from Alaska, tour keepers from Alaska. Here's the Hemingway family, which were part of our community, and my daughter in the middle. But they are now living on a 40-foot sailboat, catamaran sailboat in the Mediterranean. The wife, who's not pictured here, is pregnant, and they are going to be delivering their first child in Israel. Not their first child, but the first one they're going to deliver in Israel. They've found a midwife there, and so they're going to birth the baby there. They actually want to go and live and stay in Israel. We'll see what happens. If Yahweh wants it, that's what's going to happen. We load them on top of the cars, and we deliver them in the rain, wherever we get the food to the people. We also hand out the word. If people can read, oh, I got to talk about this guy right here. If people can read, we want them to have a copy of the scriptures. This guy could probably outsing anyone in this congregation. He was phenomenal. He was phenomenal. And the only thing he asked me, if I said, what do you need? He said, I don't have a Bible. So we made sure he got one. But this guy can belt. I'm telling you what, Aretha Franklin would have liked this guy. Okay, he can really belt. Of course, he only sings in Spanish. The Torah is going forth in Latin America. It's going forth in Costa Rica, in Nicaragua. There's a community near David in Panama. We get letters from Venezuela, from Colombia, from Argentina, from Chile. Emails, I don't mean letters, I mean emails, saying, can you come and teach us? Can you get us any information? And the best we can do right now is we put some of our teachings on our websites. Those are our website. Please go and check out. There's a lot more pictures. There's a lot more information. There's more detailed information. The top one, Project Benjamin, is in English. The bottom one, Proyecto Benjamin, is in Spanish. If you have any strictly Spanish-speaking friends, send them there. It's all in Spanish. Everything that's almost, they're a little different because we put some things in Spanish that we don't put in English because you already have it. We have some of Brad Scott's stuff on there. And of course, we don't put Brad Scott's stuff on in English because you can just go to Brad Scott's website. Why would I worry about uploading things? What a pain. But we do put it, translate it to Spanish and put it on the Spanish website. Yahweh is doing a great work of restoration in the world. the scriptures speak about him as the great restorer. Our job is restoration. That's our job to each other, to him primarily, and then to each other. I will ask for your prayers because Yahweh is doing a work of restoration in my family. We have been in full-time ministry for some 9 years, and we have been in the foreign field for 5 of them. Through that time, there have been a lot of separation in my family, in my close family. Yahweh is restoring that. It is possible that part of that restoration is our return to the U.S. But there are people in place to continue the work and be supported from a distance. But I would covet your prayers for clarity in his will, because I am here right now speaking in fellowships to see, to spread the word, to let people know what's going on in Latin America with the Sephardic people. But I'm also here seeking if the Father would have me to return. So, and I don't know. I don't know. Right now, I don't have a job offer to come here, and I don't know if I have what I need to stay there. So I'm kind of in limbo. In this week's Torah portion, we have where Moses sought diligently for the goat of the sacrifice. That word is Deresh Derash, sought diligently. It is the exact center of the Torah. It is between the past and the future. I put to you that every moment of your life, you are between the past and the future. The question is, will you seek diligently what Yahweh will have you do, and then go do it? You have any questions? I have some brochures, if anybody's interested. If you didn't write down the website, it's basically the only real useful information other than what I've shared. On the brochures are some website and some mailing information. Any questions at all about anything I shared? Any comments? The food's kicking in. Yes, Daryl. Yes. Yes. I recently got an inroad into the Orthodox community, which I have unfortunately been unable to explore. Was invited to the home of an Orthodox Jew who I made acquaintance with. He worked at the only Judaica store in Costa Rica. There's only one. And they are really proud of their stuff, let me tell you. And he worked there, and I called him. I was calling around looking for a moil. Is anyone of this the guy that does the circumcisions? For my friend Randall, for his baby. And I said, hi, I'm a friend of Jeanette. She gave me your name, and da-da-da. He goes, no, you're not Bill. I said, I'm Bill Bishop, a friend of Jeanette. I'm looking for a moil. And so, he said, you're not a friend of Jeanette. You're a friend of Joel. Joel in Spanish. And I said, Joel. The only Joel I know is Joel Sanchez, and he's a gringo. I'm thinking, Joe. I said, from Bates V. He goes, yeah. Wow, I hadn't seen him in 6 months. And he said, you know, the next time you're in town, you need to come by my house, and we need to have coffee. Now, you need to understand that when I would go into Bates V, I'm a goyim in his eyes, and he would ignore his other customers, and he would bother me for like an hour while I was in there trying to shop. And he would ask me, why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you going to churches and teaching them Torah? Who taught you Torah? What are you doing here in this country? And we would just sit and we would talk. And finally, I would have to go because I never was planning to stay quite that long. But it opened a door. So if you are diligent and you are faithful to live it, to walk it out, not just talk it out, walk it out, the doors will open for you to share to people you would never suspect you were going to be sharing with. Any other questions? Val, thank you very much.